This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. We welcome Dr. Rohana Arifin to the studio today. You are a legendary scholar, politician, an icon in Malaysian activism, at least to my eyes. And you are going to talk to us about your new book, Wanita Rentasi Perjuangan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, we had you on before, We talked a bit about
trade unions,
that's right.
Yeah. And that was your germinal work, right? That was part of your dissertation. And really, I think your major contribution to Malaysian history and Malaysian labor studies.
I love that really, that interesting use of the word germinal instead of seminal. And I know is this the politically correct term now to use germinal?
Well, that's the new preference in academia. But, you know, I wonder, on that note, what would happen to the word disseminate? Do we have to use the word degeminate now?
You know, I'm really a big believer in using the old words and just having a new attitude towards them rather than creating artificially new words that are politically correct.
Why don't we ask the feminists in the studio?
Yeah.
This seems to me more of an emphasis among liberal feminists, the idea that, you know, you change terms, language creates a certain atmosphere, and what we do instead of using these old words with their connotations and their gender biases implicit in them, or sometimes explicit in the case of, you know, seminal. What do you make of that transition? Do you feel that it's serious, or some people find it feeble? What are your thoughts on that?
I think transition in many ways are good for the society because it fits into the current situation. But the thing is, whether that word will be used in the popular sense or only understood with certain class of people, you know. So once it becomes popular in the society, then I think word should increase. You know, the more words you have, the more enriched you become.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can go with that.
Sure.
Germinal's fine. You know, I'm happy with germinal.
Yeah. But let's talk about, you know, speaking of words, we have here with us your new book. Now, from our brief conversation before recording, you said that this is more for a general audience, particularly addressing Malay youths, to talk about the fundamental ideas behind feminism. So what made you want to write this book, you know, after doing more scholarly stuff over the years?
Yeah, over the years, I've been writing academic stuff, articles and in journals and so on. Then I began to think, you know, over the years, how far has it reached the public? I noticed that in understanding feminism and certain ideology, it's always more or less confined to the academic circle, more or less confined to the university. And it becomes a kind of elitist understanding of several concepts. So I was thinking, all these years, has it been wasted? Because I was looking at the feminist struggle, it just remains a struggle. Among university students, among academics, among those who have come back from overseas, then where is this feminist idea at the grassroots, at the factory level, at women in the streets and so on? They don't seem to have an understanding from what I see. So I said, maybe I need a paradigm shift, you know. Instead of writing this stuff that is airy-fairy to a lot of people, we should go to the ground and give them some idea why their life is like that. So I was thinking about it again. I wanted to meet you to discuss, but for some reason I couldn't. So I talked to these two young gentlemen at the back of the book. These two young men, Shafiq and Lee, they were saying, why don't we come up with something that is simpler? Because now we have a lot of youth in the urban areas who are looking for some understanding and some reasoning. And some women were telling me that their boyfriend don't want them because they're considered as feminists. So I said, dude, a boyfriend really understand what feminism is all about. So after discussion, we decide that I think we should come up with a simple book, which is semi-comic in form. Mm-hmm. This is semi-comic, although the comic might not be too many here. And in simple bahasa. You know, writing in bahasa is not simple for us because we have all been educated in English language. So we try. Mm-hmm. So this is the first attempt in a semi-comic form about a serious topic. Actually, feminism is a conceptual and theoretical idea. So I was thinking that with this book, and I'm trying to see what's the readership like. We see whether ideas will spread into the society.
I mean, you know, when you look at Malaysia as a whole, our social indices in terms of gender disparity or even the intensity of patriarchal practices and culture, I wonder how Malaysia rates. You know, I think of the fact that all girl children go to school, almost all girls, and that's not true of a lot, many societies and cultures, and not just in terms of their material ability to provide schooling for girls, but ideologically opposed to the education of women. I don't think that's true here. No. It's not true of any of our traditional societies to deprive women of. We see women in leadership positions, whether politically or even economically. I mean, you know, Bangnagar governor was a woman for the longest time. Yeah. And this is not true of many advanced countries. Women haven't, in fact, achieved those. University attendance, more girls than boys. Women. So we're actually starting from a fairly high base in terms of women's opportunities. Would that be an overstatement?
Yeah, I think if you look at one angle, what you're saying is correct in the sense that you have a lot of women who are holding important positions in certain places. It's not a token because these women are really qualified and so on. And there are also women in the academic field, women in the university. But if you look at the subjects which they take, it's quite still gender stratified. And if you look at, you said that a lot of age-going school children are also girls and so on, because it has become universal education after 1957. So a lot of women goes there and so on. But the thing is, if you look at the structure of the education system, you still find that a lot of headmasters and so on are still men. I'm not begrudging them, but what I mean is a lot of the women still hold supportive position. And if you look at women in the labour market, they're also holding roles that are very feminine in the sense like welfare workers, they're also
service industry.
But if you compare Malaysian women with Thailand and surrounding areas, we still are quite lag behind in the sense of representation.
We lag behind?
Yeah, we still lag behind in representation. If you look at women representation in parliament, we should say now that we have increased, but over the years, it's around 10 to 12% still, you know. Maybe in Penang, there's a bit more under the opposition. But overall, you find that women are increasingly supportive in politics still. Although they have women leaders here, but the icon of the women in politics, I would say, quite stereotype and quite conservative. Let me give you an example. Because the Malays are the majority here, they have women in UMNO, they have women in PKR, they have women in other spheres of politics. You see, they have certain stereotype iconic they must be, because the woman has to be married. She must have a husband. She must get the permission of the husband to be a politician. She cannot neglect her duty, you know. And she must be dressed in certain Ella Arabic way now, you know. So you find that although women are economically, I say, better than in the 70s, there are many areas of gender understanding that has to be clarified.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's a question of, yes, we may be a higher starting point in terms of other countries, but there's still a lot of challenges that are left. I'm wondering if the challenges are, you know, about deep-seated ideological positions with regard to women. And some people would say that women are constitutionally incapable of doing certain jobs, you know, or that women, you know, have to be protected. I mean, there are all these ways of talking about women that are expressive of patriarchal attitudes, right?
Well, what I sense from your examples, Dr. Rohana, is that they're still tied to family expectations or bonds. So even if they are in the labor market, the expectation is that they serve certain caregiving type roles or something along those lines.
You know, yeah, but you still have a lot of women doctors. Would men, for instance, maybe this is a weird test, would men say, I won't see a woman doctor?
Now it's true what you say, because people here can expect any doctor for that matter. But if you look at specialists and surgeons, you still can see the statistics that it's men more. It's not that the women doctors do not want to graduate further or take specialization, but they have these two roles to play, which I emphasize in this book, that women are still expected to do the majority of housework and are responsible for the house. Especially this is among the working class women, which cannot afford
helper
at home. So they have to fulfill that function. So you find that they go to the office, they go to the factory, and coming back, they have to perform that function. This is similar to the women in the estate before, where the Indian women has to work in the rubber estate as well as come back. That's why I relate it to the capitalist system that we are in now, because the reproduction of labour again at home to go back to the factory, to go back to the workplace, is still carried out by women. It's not carried out by the capitalist system. It's not carried out by the employers. It is carried out by the women at home to fulfil this function of feeding the future labour market, to teach the future children and so on. So I find that although women fulfil a very important reproductive function in our capitalist society, they're not given the recognition, although there are proposals towards it.
Yeah, I think the key implication here is that while we can look at indicators of labour participation, right, the next question is how much more unwanted work do they have to do, right? So one thing, they are participating in the economy, but they also have unrecognised work at home.
So this domestic sphere. This dual atmosphere is still very much tied to the women. But as Gerard said just now, you know, we are at a good starting point if you compare to 1970. But you must remember in the 1970, there's a backlash of conservatism. First with the uprise of the, you know,
revivalist Muslim
in
movements,
Iran.
Yeah. Oh, right.
You're right. And then, of course, the backlash came here because of the urbanization process. A lot of the youth that comes into the urban area looking for answers. So, and then, of course, when Saudi saw that Iran is coming up, I mean, politically, so they start to spread their Wahhabism through a lot of finance and institution and setting up universities and colleges, which also influenced the Islamic perspective in Malaysia. So from a very, I would say from a quite a progressive perspective of women in the 50s and 60s, you find that now the atmosphere have changed into a more conservative expectation of women, which a lot of women are accepting. If you go around now in public places, you find that even in discussion, they find that you have to be at home. The first duty of a good Muslim woman, a good woman, is to take care of your family. After that, go to your job, you know. So there is actually a reversal in the progress of women in this country. And I'm quite concerned about that because I find that although they say that feminism is no longer relevant now, I think feminism is more relevant now because we have to emphasize on the democratic rights of everyone in society, women, children, and men.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot there for us to process, and we'll do just that in the second part of the show. But let's take a break for now. This is Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharuk Kutin. And our guest this week is Dr. Rohana Arifin, who's here to talk to us about her latest book, Wanita Rentasi Perjuangan, basically a feminist primer for our local youth. And this is BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharuk Kutin. And we have in our studio a special guest, Dr. Rohana Arifin, who's here to talk to us about her latest book, Wanita Rentasi Perjuangan, a primer introductory text about feminism for young Malaysians. And it's designed to be accessible, to be very legible for a general public, with a lot of the academic terms simplified. And it is accompanied also by a lot of arresting visuals. So in the first part of the show, we talked about your motivations behind the book, and we got an overview of the situation of women's rights in Malaysia. I do want to probe further regarding the state of feminist discourse in Malaysia, particularly women and representation in the country overall. And one of the issue where I think this is more glaring as a problem is when we talk about historical figures, right? So we talk about Malaysian historical figures, there are rarely any women, right? Yeah. Typically, we talk about the founding fathers and the movements, but also the four prime ministers. And in doing so, we often fail to mention or recognize that, you know, women also contribute to independence and the struggle against colonization. And this is where one of the interesting things about your book stands out, in that you really localize a lot of the figures in the book. I get it that you mentioned Juliet Mitchell, for example, or feminist thinkers in the West, but you also mentioned Khadijah Sidik and Shamsia Fakeh.
True. Because I think in history, whoever is a ruling government will always give their version of history. But at the same time, even if you look at some of the more progressive books in this country about history, very rarely women are mentioned. Of course, you have names like Khadijah Sidik, which came out much later. Shamsia Fakeh wrote her own memoir, you know. But there are also women who have joined the struggle in, let's say, in the 1985, in WAO, in AWAM, in Women Crisis Center. These women have sacrificed a lot of their time to bring up issues which was considered not important at that time. They considered this issue as very personal. For instance, the Domestic Violence Act was not implemented until 1994. That struggle took about 10 years to have it passed because a lot of the conservative people will say, you know, how can you interfere in the domestic sphere? This is the husband's right, you know, the husband's right to beat his wife to some extent and so on. So we've struggled against that. So you find that, of course, after the 1980s, you find that very few of the women, I would say fighters, are mentioned in any of the struggle. So for me, the grassroots struggle, the social struggle committed by the women should be kept in history, should be written down in history. And I think I did mention a few here about sisters in Islam, but I didn't name names, you know. But I would like to appreciate what women organizations have done for society, for improving society, like Tenaga Nita and Irene and all that. I didn't mention names because to me, icons are important. But to me, the struggle of the ordinary person should be highlighted.
What about the question of the acceptance, either by men or women, of the leadership of women? I mean, some women are in leadership positions, as you kind of alluded to earlier, because perhaps they are the wives of, or, you know, daughters of. But when you think of, say, the leadership of Berce, and I'm thinking here because I see Maria Chin has written forward along with Dr. Nasir Hashim from Parti Socialist Malaysia. Maria, and of course before her, Ambika Srinivasan, you know, they both occupy that position. I'm wondering if you talk to young people, Rohana, do they think this is a problem? Do they think, oh, it's a woman leading this, I can't take this seriously? I wouldn't have thought so. I think that, you know, most young people don't really put so much store on this, unless they're steeped in a very deeply conservative thing where there's this clear sense that women don't have those leadership or should not have those leadership roles.
It's true. I think when it comes to politics and leading the movement like Maria and so on, just regrets a bit that I know Maria Chin's husband very well for a long time. I know Yunus Ali and Hisham, you know, they were my younger comrades. And they were very supportive of feminist struggles and so on. So Maria, in that sense, and Yunus were lucky that they were husbands and wife, and Maria goes out to work and Yunus becomes the house husband. You know, this is quite an exceptional case. What I mean is that now Berce, because people have opened up their mind to politics, so they don't mind who's leading the movement and so on. But at the same time, if you go at a personal level, if you go down to the household level, if you go down to relationship level, I think a lot of men are still very wary of feminist women, you know. They always say that feminists are anti-men, you know. So what I'm trying to do here is to show that feminism is not anti-men. Maybe we are anti-men who are violent. We're anti-men who are pedophile, you know. But we're not anti-men who believe in the democratic right of other people.
Okay, but isn't that true? If you promote the interests of women, the self-interests of men, right? They're trying to control things. I mean, they have to yield. Like, say, for instance, you did have, and political parties are a prime example of this. Of course, they want to get the women's vote. And you know, 50% of the voting population is women. But it's a struggle for positions. Everybody wants to be a member of parliament. So they're going to fight tooth and nail. And they will think, well, actually, people will still vote for us even when we don't have enough female representation. I mean, where is the real problem? Is it a problem of just men holding on, or that the general population doesn't make this demand? It doesn't say we want more women.
Okay, that point highlights to me the difference between the examples in civil society that we mentioned, right? Like Ambika and Maria Chin. And on the other hand, politics as a broader superstructure. And I would just suddenly, it just occurred to me to think about, was this 3 years ago when there was a lot of controversy around Wan Azizah possibly being the chief minister of Selangor, right? And then you had, at a national level, somehow that debate happening, right?
Yeah, but that was because PAS didn't. PAS ideologically is opposed
of course
to female leadership.
But there was national currency. People took it on. Because I think there's a sense in which civil society is still viewed as not as threatening as a woman in the highest office of the richest state in the country, right? So, yes, these women can march in the streets. Yes, they can sit on the platforms and yell anti-government slogans, but they don't really have power. And for as long as that remains the case, then of course we don't mind having women as these icons. But when it comes to running the bureaucracy, right? And the bureaucracy with the 30 years of its own routine and its own gendered biases already imprinted, then gender maybe becomes an issue.
Because politics is very important in this country now, you know. But there are certain questions I like to ask, which I ask in this book, saying that the women who enter politics, do they enter politics because they want to follow the policy of the political party, or they are there to represent the voice of the women? Because a lot of statements which women politicians make reflect the political party. They don't really push for the issue of gender in their party, except for some cases, you know. And I'm glad that there are women in parliament too, which are against sexism and so on. So I think in this sense, it's very difficult for women to come up in the political ladder because of the experience of men. Men have earlier exposure. So I also wonder, why can't women be the prime minister in this country? Maybe that will, you know.
Well, you know, BFM, we did a survey, a poll, and most BFM listeners say no problem when it comes to women's leadership. I don't want to say, though, just a little segue in terms of social attitudes. We had recently the MP of Tasik Galugo saying that, you know, victims of rape should marry their rapist because that would ensure their, I don't know, their future or something.
The shame of the victim.
And then, you know, somehow deliver the family from that shame. But then one of the strident voices that came out was actually a past MP for Kota Raja, MP for Kota Raja.
Yeah,
and she, came and she said, look, you know, this is all kind of thinking, right? In Malay, you say kolot, right? It means this is kind of like Zaman Purba kind of thing, thinking, caveman thinking, where she's saying, well, this might have been true of a time, but now women can aspire to so much more than their mothers and grandmothers did. And I thought that was interesting that she, speaking from a political party that's seen as deeply conservative, still held what we would consider fairly progressive views.
But then I also wonder why we have MPs like that who give such a statement, you know.
Well, he's a man though.
Yeah, right? He's a man, but why do we have this kind of quality of male leadership? And I think this is a problem of our political electorate in this country, that we vote people in certain political party. We don't vote people for their ideas, for their independent stand, you know. So we're going to continue having this kind of problem. But I agree with you that Tamaria, I think her name was, she did say something. But it's also not true that in the past, this is okay. In the past, because I think certain society that come out in the Middle East, they do not have any understanding of the psychology of a child, the cognitive development of a child. They think that the moment a child is reached puberty, you can marry her off, you know. And then she have children. And then she's also still a child. You see what happened in some of the tribal area in Pakistan? They still allow, you know, this to me, it's pedophile, you know, marrying a child of below a certain age. So this is also a controversy in this country. But you find that a lot of women, they do speak up against it when such a blatant statement is made. But I don't know about the majority of the other women, you know, who are caught up in this kind of conservative understanding or position of gender relations. But maybe your FM readers and so on, they are middle class educated people, you know. But I'm not sure about the other readers and the other listeners from the other radio. I'm not sure of that.
Dr. Rana, I'm just wondering if you can comment a little bit on empirical studies done in anthropology and also in political science. Recently, Charles Hirschman published something last year surveying the literature on the power of women in Malaysia in the domestic sphere. And then he compares it with findings in the Middle East to show that in Southeast Asia, and to an extent, this applies to the Caribbean too, like the climate is more tropical, women have more say when it comes to managing the affairs of the household. Yeah. Now, this can be negative in the sense that you do more work, but it's somewhat interesting in that you control the family's finances as well, right? This could be from small plantation holdings to small farming, but also to more later day under the NEP, the family's budget, so on and so forth. And this is unique in a certain sense to our context that doesn't quite apply to the Middle East, doesn't quite apply to the West. And this might actually contribute to our relative openness to them in leadership, right?
I think I did mention in his book that we have to look at the evolution of that society. Society that evolved from an agriculture base like Malaysia, the women have more function because they go, you know, they also help in fishing, they also go to the paddy, and they do medicine and so on. But those who comes from the herding society like Middle East and Pakistan and all that, you can find that the position of women is more confined to the home because herding society, only the men goes out. So you find that even the position of women coming up from an agricultural society like Indonesia, Malaysia and so on, we tend to have a bit more space, a bit more freedom, a bit more recognition. Of course, after the coming of private property, these things have changed quite a bit, you know. For instance, like the matriarchal law in Minangkabau and so on. Last time they have women who control the clan and so on. But now with the adat temenggong that comes in after the patriarchal society sweeps most society, then women began to lose their position. But as you said, relatively, of course, women from the agriculture background has a better position in terms of space and recognition than women from herding society.
But what about the role of the state, do you think, in Malaysia? Hasn't the state, in fact, been largely an ally of women in terms of education, in terms of opportunities, mm-hmm. in terms of even recently, maybe now a decade ago when Abdullah Ahmad Badawi was the prime minister, they included gender in the constitution when it came to non-discrimination,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So they have been, the state, correct me if I'm wrong, has been an ally of women. Perhaps not enough for some people, but it has largely been an ally to women.
Yeah, to some extent, you're right. Because I think the state gives scholarship to women as well if they want to go in certain field and so on. But what I'm saying is that we have this kind of two forces at work, you know. One, you can have the economic imperialism and so on. But what I'm trying to say also in this book is the cultural imperialism that comes from a very conservative interpretation of women's position. And this is really pressing a lot of the women who believe in certain religion in this country. So you find that even if the state tries to liberate women in some aspect, with a certain attitude, I wouldn't say that the state is oppressive. I would say that the state is liberal in helping women, but there are also other conservative forces in society which the state have to tackle as well if you want the women to progress.
So why is it that women themselves have chosen to be oppressed by this? Are they receptive when they have opportunities and the state in fact is helping them? Why have these conservative ideologies found fertile ground with Malaysians? Is it a disappointment with the promises of freedom?
I think it's because of the structure the state has allowed in Malaysia. You know, we have all kinds of institutions that continue to propagate this kind of ideology. And you find that, for instance, take an example of polygamy. You know, polygamy, where Sisters in Islam have done a 2-year study on the implications of polygamy, especially to the children, because you have an absentee father, you know, because this man thinks that when he marries, it's okay. But the implications on the children, which have seen absentee father, and then when the father died, you know, they have to spread the will against so many pieces of the property. And then you find that the children are not given quality parenting by the parents. So there is a good study, a study on the effect of polygamy. But still, a lot of women are okay with polygamy, especially with the men as well. Polygamy, even if we talk to some of the friends that I have, they say it's better to be a second wife than to be a mistress, they say, you know. So to me, that's not okay. Both ways, that I don't think it's okay because it's serving the interests of another party.
Well, the mistress has no legal rights. Yeah. I think that's where the difference is, right? And if you are a second wife, you do in fact have a contractual relationship.
That means you're encouraging it, isn't it? When you give a legal right, you are encouraging that thing.
But right? The broader question of how it is that these hierarchies are accepted and internalized as part of your identity has a lot to do with socialization processes,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So we are born into a conservative climate. Most of the time, we just take whatever it is that the textbook and our family says. And it's only much later when we run into the contradictions of the system that we start questioning it, right?
Yeah,
so unfortunately, conflict is always like a spark for more critical questions. But since you're here, I also want to talk about whether trade union spaces is much of an alternative, because one of the perceptions that shroud trade unionism is that it's still masculine.
Yeah.
It's still largely a very male-dominated space, even though women depend on trade union action, you know, because so much of women's oppression issues are tied to labor,
yeah.
right? And so how about trade unionism in Malaysia? Can you assess its successes or challenges in incorporating women as well?
Well, because of the many various laws that govern trade union, the trade union has sort of gone down on a downward spiral. Like, for instance, only 10% of the working population are involved in trade unions. And as I said also in this book, that because the women have practically no time to do any other alternative, you know, because first you have to work and then you have to go home and prepare the family dinner and so on. So they have no time for a third activity. So this has affected, as I said in my earlier book, that women who are single, when they go into trade union, they are trained as leaders, you know, leadership training. And then when it comes to the fourth or fifth year, they got married, there you are, there's no more leaders. You know, there's only one or two, like Kamala and all these people, you know. So unless and until the system of work, the system of domestic arrangement is changed, you find that very few women will involve themselves in trade union. And I think this, I want to also mention that my next book, which is in the pipeline, is talking about the struggle of electronic workers union, in which you find that 90% of them are women workers. The one who organize them are male, men unionists, because they are in the mechanic level, they are the middle level. But you find that even with the leadership of the trade unions, which are men, which are very pro-worker, and then with all the labor laws that prevent them, they can be easily sacked. You know, I have known a few trade union friends who have no job for the last 6-7 years. And fortunately for them, their wife is working. Otherwise, who's going to support them? You know, once you have a trade union reputation, no other companies will take you. So it's also a gender question. At the same time, it's also a class question for me.
You are still a committed leftist. I mean, you still believe that work is the front line for liberation of women.
True.
To what extent do you subscribe to the Marxist critique of the family? Right, because it assumes an oppressive structure because it's connected to the reproduction of workers, good workers, obedient workers, deferential to authority. Right, but in your own view, I know Malaysia is a long way to go until we even get to that level. Right, but in your own view, and what's motivated your work, how do you problematize the family, if at all?
Because when I was younger, I used to read one of the good books on women in the family is by Trotsky. Trotsky has a very good small book he wrote about how women are not free in the domestic sphere. And also then, of course, you have Angel's books on the private property and so on. So this gave me a kind of perspective. When I look at the situation, market situation now, there's a lot of changes, of course. Now the labour market is not only women workers, which is in the semi-skill level, but you also have foreign workers which are coming in to break the power of the working class. So now the situation have a sort of change. But even if you look at the migrant women who come to work here, many of them are single. They still have to go back to their, you know, to their country. But even those women who are here for many years and have worked in the factory, we have done a study actually in Penang a few years ago before I left university. We interviewed factory women 20 years later. You know, we did a study. And many of them are, of course, married to their factory workers, the bus driver, the taxi drivers. So they are still in the working class. They are still in the working class family with a certain amount of small, limited amount of money. And they're still doing the housework. And they're still going to the factory after 20 years. So the position of many of the local women have not changed much, sad to say, you know. And then when I asked them, you know, what else can you... And they also say that we are not going to go back to the rural areas. That means they are bringing in new urban values to their children. And if you look at the case of lepak, this motorbike racing and all that, it's all very tied up to the system of work. Because they are what you call the latchkey kids. When they come back from school, their parents are not there. They have the makan all on the table. Then you study on your own. You have your own brothers and sisters. And the next stage, of course, they go to the air-conditioned place. Because in a low-cost flat, the atmosphere is very hot and very noisy. So what they do is they go to the next nice place, which is the supermarket. Then you find them hanging around, you know. So a lot of people say, you know, we must moralize them, give them sense of moral, you know, and activity. Of course, I agree to that as well, activity. But I think we have to solve the root cause of why the urban youth have become like this. For instance, that, you know, the youth that were killed recently in Johor and all that, these are all related to the urbanization, the housing, the parenting, the law and so on. Yeah.
Well, that's a broad sweep of history of feminism in Malaysia and its contemporary issues it has to face. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But before we wrap up, we have recommendations. Sharat, do you have anything in mind to recommend?
Well, in the back of the book, you actually have a quote by this Egyptian writer, Nawal El-Sadawi. And I just thought of a novel of hers I read when I was 18, Woman at Point Zero, which I think it's really important for young men, I mean, in the battle against patriarchy and its practices and cultures, that you create allies among young men, because that's really half the story, right? So yeah, and I think it was a real eye-opener for me as a young man to read her book, Nawal El-Sadawi's Woman at Point Zero.
Yeah. You also mentioned Juliet Mitchell in the book, which is to me a very, very refreshing mentioning, because especially, you know, when you want to put it in the Malaysian context, we'd rarely see her name around, but she's a psychoanalyst. And I think a very valuable resource to understand why it is that the ideology of gender is very tempting, right? So it goes back to Sharat's question. How is it that we subscribe to the very structures that work against us, right? That there's that emotional attachment to that. So psychoanalysis and feminism is perhaps the more academic kind of book she wrote, she's well known for. But Woman's Estate, the work before that as well, was very influential. Yeah, which I think you cite in this book. But once again, of course, I'm sure you want to plug your book, right? Perhaps any final words you want to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, I do hope that, because this is a semi-comic book written in Malay, you know, which is very seldom. And I find it quite difficult to write in Malay because we are all educated in this English. But I try because I hope that, It can go to the streets or go to during exhibition where there are a lot of youth and youth group or the Ministry of Youth and so on. We'll try to read this book, not because we want to feminize them. No, we just want to show the youth that the position of women now, how women has become what they are now, and the reading is very simple.
Yeah, maybe you should try putting serializing it on Twitter or putting it on Facebook, because Facebook actually is an extraordinary platform for dissemination. I think more than books today.
Yeah.
You know, if you want people to read, Facebook would be the place, especially for young people, especially in the Malay language. I think Facebook is really big.
Mm. Are you on Twitter, Dr. Rohana?
No, I'm not on Twitter.
But
I'm
you are on
Facebook.
Facebook. Okay,
yeah,
so Facebook. People can look you up on Facebook if they want to know more about discuss these issues. And Sharat is at Sharat Kutat.
I am indeed.
Yes.
Yes, of course.
And you can email the show, bfmnightschool@gmail.com, or look us up on Facebook as well. That is BFM Night School. Just type that on the search space. Once again, thank you, Dr. Rohana Arifin, for joining us. And once again, the book is called Wanita Rentasi Perjuangan. It's available at Gerak Budaya. And if I'm not mistaken, it's RM25.
Yeah, it's also available through Shafiq and Lee, because they will be going online and you can buy the book for RM20.
RM20 online. And I will post a link to the book as well online so that people can look up Shafiq and Lee. They're actually at the back page as well, posing with you in the midst of processing this book. Now, you're also urged to download BFM's app that is at the Google Play Store. It's also available on the Apple App Store. Thanks again for listening. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, Sharat Kutan, and Rohana Arifin was also on the show to discuss feminism in Malaysia. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.